Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Drew Courtney of the group People for the American Way, who talks about the growing controversy over conservative Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas' ethical standards. Terry Nelson, a retired U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agent, who discusses the cost of the drug war in terms of lives ruined and tax dollars expended while offering an alternative vision for reform. And psychiatrist and author Bruce Levine, who examines the political passivity of many Americans and the strategies that can help people regain confidence and empower them to challenge an unjust status quo. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On September 24, 2010, FBI agents raided the homes of 23 leftist activists in Chicago and Minneapolis as part of a long-running terrorism investigation. Those arrested all refused to testify before a federal grand jury in Chicago, asserting they only engaged in peaceful protests and have long ties with key labor unions and community organizations. According to news reports, federal agents are attempting to link those arrested with activities that provided material support for Colombian and Palestinian groups labeled as terrorists by the U.S. government. The investigation dates back to the protests at the 2008 Republican National Convention. Since then, the FBI has investigated activists for their participation in fact-finding trips to Colombia and the Palestinian territories. Chicago lawyer Michael Deutsch, who is defending the 23 activists, claims they are public, nonviolent activists with long, distinguished careers in public service, including teachers, union organizers, as anti-war and community leaders. The activists and their supporters, including labor unions, have formed the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, which has urged the U.S. Department of Justice to drop the case. Civil liberties defenders point to a recent report by the Department of Justice Inspector General blasting the FBI for monitoring domestic advocacy groups ranging from Greenpeace to People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, in anti-terrorism investigations. In January, the United Nations General Assembly created a new agency, UN Women, to give gender equity a higher profile in the international community. Yet the Interpress Service reports UN Women, headed by former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet, is off to a slow start, only raising $80 million in donor pledges, far short of initial goals. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for an initial annual budget of $500 million for the new agency. At its current rate of fundraising, the organization will have to cut its budget in half. UN Women merged four agencies. New York-based Equity Now fears UN Women could be marginalized like the smaller UN agencies it replaced. Stephen Lewis, a former Canadian ambassador to the UN and top UNICEF official, lamented, "At the moment, UN Women is being strangled at birth by a coalition of wealthy nations." Before Hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans in 2005, Charity Hospital was a robust urban public medical center that served the city's poor African-American population and trained medical students from Tulane and Louisiana State University, or LSU. 6 years after Katrina, Charity Hospital sits damaged and vacant. Charity's owner, LSU, has used recovery funds to finance a long-sought $1.2 billion medical complex far removed from Charity's poor indigent population. The new hospital complex has not yet started construction, and critics warn of shaky finances. According to The Nation magazine, Charity Hospital could easily have been repaired, since it didn't suffer extensive damage from the 2005 hurricane. An outside consultant found Charity could have been converted into a state-of-the-art teaching hospital for half of the cost of LSU's new hospital complex. To build its new hospital, LSU took control of 37 acres in the racially mixed mid-city neighborhood and cleared the site by bulldozing affordable working-class housing and small neighborhood businesses. At the moment, LSU is $300 million short of raising the funds needed to build the new $1.2 billion complex. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
when President George H.W. Bush nominated conservative appeals court judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1991, controversy followed. Allegations of sexual harassment made by Anita Hill, a former Thomas employee at the Department of Education, made for high drama during televised Senate hearings and placed the nomination in doubt. But in the end, Thomas was confirmed and took his seat on the Supreme Court. Now, a gathering storm of questions related to Justice Thomas' ethical conduct has prompted media scrutiny and calls in Congress for an investigation. Since becoming an associate justice, Clarence Thomas has cultivated relationships with rich and powerful individuals who at times have been associated with cases that have come before the high court. But time and again, despite the appearance of conflicts of interest, Justice Thomas has refused to recuse himself from sitting in judgment on these cases. One of Thomas' friends, real estate entrepreneur Harlan Crow, has contributed funds to a library and museum project dedicated to Thomas in Georgia, while also showering the justice and his wife with expensive gifts, including giving startup funds for Thomas' wife Ginny's Tea Party group, Liberty Central. Earlier this year, Representative Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, proposed a bill that would end the Supreme Court's immunity to federal ethics laws, which apply to all other federal judges. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Drew Courtney, Director of Communications with the group People for the American Way. He talks about the growing controversy over conservative Justice Clarence Thomas' ethical standards.
You know, the concerns are really that there's been a broad pattern of ethically dubious behavior that we've gotten from Justice Thomas. And there's some around disclosure, some around acceptance of gifts, some around whether or not he's filled out the disclosure forms. And in some ways, the disclosure questions are the most questionable because those verge on what could be criminal behavior, and we really need answers from him. You know, on one hand, that one item that's been recently highlighted by the New York Times in a very extensively, thoroughly reported piece is his relationship with a billionaire investor named Harlan Crow, who has, through either his own personal connections or through organizations he's been on the board with, given Thomas a tremendous amount of gifts. So, for instance, Thomas accepted a bust of Lincoln from the American Enterprise Institute, on whose board Harlan Crow serves, worth $15,000. He accepted a $19,000 Bible owned by Frederick Douglass. He's been on Harlan Crow's yacht. He's been hosted at his estates in California, in Texas, in the Adirondacks. And Crow even donated $500,000 to Justice Thomas's wife's Tea Party group when she was starting it up. So all of this money, which had not been, in many cases, not been previously disclosed at all, is a really uncomfortable situation for anybody who believes that in the court of law you should be able to go in and be heard whether you're rich or poor equally. What we've seen is that organizations on whose board Harlan Crow serves have had a great track record with Justice Thomas before the court. So he's on the board of the American Enterprise Institute. The American Enterprise Institute has filed brief in three cases, and what do you know? Justice Thomas agreed with them in all three. On the Center for Community Integrity, they filed eight briefs before the court. And in that case, Justice Thomas has agreed with all eight. Now, it's unclear exactly in each case, is there a quid pro quo? We don't know. But we need answers from Justice Thomas about why he's accepted these things, what is the extent of his relationship, and why isn't he recusing himself from these questionable cases?
What's the response of Justice Thomas to these allegations of his crossing the line on ethics?
Well, they have been very typical for Justice Thomas, and that is so far they have been essentially silenced, at least since the last round of allegations came out. Justice Thomas very famously this February made it 5 years without having asked a question in any oral argument case before the Supreme Court. And so far, that's basically what we've gotten from him in response to that. We say he's totally entitled not to ask questions if that's the way he sees fit. But at this point, he really does need to answer them, and that's what we're pushing for more than anything else. In the past, he's said about other allegations, these are liberal attempts to discredit the court, to smear me personally. But when you look at the facts, that doesn't hold up. We haven't gotten any answers. We haven't gotten any explanations, and we really need them.
When it comes to not filing financial disclosure forms, Drew, what can be done to hold Justice Thomas to account? What standards does he have to abide by? None?
Well, the first thing we need is we need more information. And so people need to keep the pressure on as far as asking for information. But the step that I think would make the most difference is that Congressman Chris Murphy has introduced legislation that would extend the Judicial Code of Ethics up to the Supreme Court. That's very, very important, because that would make it very clear why justices that were sitting on cases and why they weren't, whether they were recusing themselves in cases where there were instances in which they had an interest or somebody who gave them money had an interest before the court. And I think that's fundamentally what we have to do. There's a move to have hearings in the House. Of course, it's controlled right now by Republicans, so we can't be optimistic about those moving forward. There's a possibility of hearings in the Senate. And I think there's more digging to be done, and there's more digging that is being done to find out exactly what has gone on so far, especially with what I think, in my opinion, these flights. And Thomas has got to answer these questions.
Drew Courtney, what about other groups of attorneys, associations of attorneys like the American Bar Association? Have they weighed in on this issue of Supreme Court ethics, and specifically Justice Thomas and the appearance of impropriety here?
You know, I can't speak to what every other organization has done. I can, you know, speak for a limited set of organizations that I either work for or am intimately familiar with. I do think one thing that's important to note is that there was a letter that was circulated among the legal community that went to Congress basically saying in support of Chris Murphy's legislation, which was signed on by well over 100 law professors around the country, mostly legal ethicists and specialists, who said, this is a serious enough problem that it has got to be addressed right now. And then there have been a lot of other organizations that have taken various tacks, from asking whether or not that there be a Justice Department investigation of whether Thomas and Scalia should have recused themselves from the Citizens United decision, to pushing for more robust hearings in both houses of Congress, to simply trying to make sure that this stays in the headlines and that news organizations are doing their job and continuing to push this. There's been great reporting so far, and we need more of it.
That was Drew Courtney, Director of Communications with the group People for the American Way. Find more information about the controversy surrounding Justice Clarence Thomas by visiting our website at btlonline.org. In October 2009, the U.S. Border Patrol fired a probationary employee, Brian Gonzalez, just before his 2-year probationary period was up. He was terminated for the personal opinions he expressed several months earlier to a fellow officer. Gonzalez told his coworker that the best way to reduce drug-related violence on the U.S.-Mexico border was by legalizing narcotics. He also stated that as a Mexican-American, he understood why many Mexicans felt they had no choice but to try to enter the U.S. without documents in search of jobs. On January 20th of this year, the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico filed a lawsuit against the Border Patrol for firing Gonzalez on the basis of his personal beliefs expressed in a casual conversation rather than his job performance. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, is supporting Gonzalez. The group is made up of 30,000 mostly retired police, judges, prosecutors, and others who believe the U.S. drug war, which was launched in June 1971, has been an expensive failure, and that legalizing and taxing drugs would reduce violence. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Terry Nelson, a retired U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agent who spent 30 years fighting the drug war in the U.S.-Mexico border and throughout Central and South America. He discusses the cost of the drug war in terms of lives ruined and tax dollars expended, while offering an alternative vision for reform.
For example, we spent a little over $7 billion on Plan Colombia to eradicate the cocoa crop. At the end of the program, the vice president of Colombia announced that cocoa production was up 27%. And instead of lowering the production, it actually raised it. We get about 16 to 17% of the narcotics that's being shipped to us. We interdict that much. The rest of it gets through. So let's say, for example, we got 50% of the narcotics that are coming through. All that would do is drive up the price on the remaining 50% and increase the violence, because the trade routes would be more lucrative. So it's a hamster wheel. You get on it, you can't get off that way. So our lead position is that we need to change our total strategy from one of interdiction and prohibition of the narcotics to legalization, whereas you have a chance to regulate and control the distribution of manufacture and who can buy it, who can sell it, and you take the criminal cartels and drug gangs out of the matrix. Now, we acknowledge that this doesn't fix our drug problem. This fixes the crime and violence problem and the 30,000 lives that have been lost in Mexico in the last 3.5 years. We do away with most of the violence, not all of it, but, you know, probably 80% of the violence we'll do away with. Our drug problem is a social problem and a medical problem, best dealt with through education. And when you fall through the cracks, you become addicted, or you know, you start abusing certain drugs, and you need medical care to cure yourself of it. Putting a person in prison doesn't cure their addiction. It just postpones it till they get back out. Plus, it also puts him in contact with true criminals that are in there for violent reasons. So we think it's a hamster wheel, and the best way would be to legalize it, regulate and control it, educate and treat. And the places that have done it, i.e. Portugal, they just released a 10-year study where they decriminalized all drugs. They didn't legalize them because of the United Nations treaties that we have with the whole world. But they have half the drug use in Portugal that the surrounding countries in Europe do, and what we have here in the United States. Ironically, the countries with the harshest penalties, Britain and America, have the highest drug use. So you see what we're basing our argument on is it would be certainly more humane because we put 2.2 million people in prison each year, and 1.8 million of those are nonviolent drug offenders, of which 800 and some odd thousand are marijuana possession alone. And the government has no issue prosecuting you, convicting you, and then sending you to a treatment center. Let's just do away with that conviction, because you can get over an addiction. You will never get over a conviction. It follows you the rest of your life. If you don't give them this felony sentence, then you can treat them and you make them well, and they can go out and start paying taxes on a higher salary, and they're not a drain on society, then become a plus to society.
Terry Nelson, just about every state and the federal government are facing huge budget holes this year. Even if we didn't legalize and therefore tax drugs, just ending the mass incarceration of nonviolent drug offenders would save billions of dollars. Do you think the budget crisis will help your cause?
Well, we've always believed that there would be a watershed event that came along that really pushed our movement forward very rapidly, and the collapse of the economy is one of them. But we spend around $70 billion a year prosecuting the drug war. The people putting in jail, the $30,000 a year to keep a person in jail, the court costs, the police costs, the overtime costs, all this stuff. So that's about $70 billion right there. And Jeffrey Meriden, the Harvard professor, economics professor, guesstimated we could make probably $17 to $20 billion in tax revenue off of taxing it. But just the social savings alone would be phenomenal.
There's a debate in some circles, you know, between those who support decriminalization or medicalization, but not legalization. Why does LEAP support legalization, which I guess is the most extreme of these options?
Because decriminalization doesn't fix the core problem, which is the drug cartels and criminal street gangs that control the distribution. They're the violent ones, not the users. It's not just America that has this. This is a global problem. In America, we have a very low death rate compared to other parts of the world. We have like 9 per 100,000 here, and Jamaica has 38, 39 per 100,000. And remember, 30,000 people have been killed in Mexico in the last 3.5 years since Plan Medida went into effect. LEAP has members in 90 different countries in the world, by the way. So, you know, we have people on the streets telling us what's going on there. We understand the global effects of this drug war. And so even if we could manage to control the intake here in America to some extent, it would just push it up in other parts of the world. So you haven't fixed the problem. You put a Band-Aid on this area. And believe me, once they start tightening down over there, the bleeding effect will come into play, and the usage will come back here once you gear down a little bit. So you need to fix the problem.
That was Terry Nelson of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. This interview was originally broadcast on Between the Lines in February. For more information on the work of LEAP, visit our website at btlonline.org. Throughout world history, there are countless examples of how an activated and engaged group of citizens have banded together to successfully effect political and social change. Today, across the Middle East and North Africa, autocratic governments and monarchies are being challenged as never before by large numbers of people who have taken to the streets and risked their lives to demand change. Tens of thousands of people in Spain and Greece have risen up to resist the harsh economic austerity measures demanded of them by the European Union and the continent's largest banks. Yet here in America, despite high unemployment, a record number of mortgage foreclosures, and a government which refuses to prosecute Wall Street and bank executives responsible for crashing the economy, it is difficult to find organized expressions of public anger. During this economic crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, Americans by and large appear apathetic or resigned to playing the role of mere spectators in an era witnessing a steep decline in the standard of living for millions. There are, however, exceptions to widespread indifference in the U.S. Take, for example, the massive protests in Madison, Wisconsin, where earlier this year, tens of thousands of pro-union activists organized weeks of rallies, a takeover of the Capitol building, and recall elections to oppose anti-labor legislation. Bruce Levine is a clinical psychologist whose new book is titled Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Levine about the factors he believes contribute to the political passivity and fatalism of many Americans and the strategies that can help people regain confidence and empower them to challenge an unjust status quo.
Actually, when I first heard the term liberation theology, I thought, geez, there should be also a liberation psychology in my profession, because I'm a clinical psychologist. And, you know, routinely my profession is increasingly, and Eric Fromm, the great democratic socialist psychoanalyst, predicted this, and he was more right than he thought he would be, that we become just more one more part of the problem in the sense of helping people adapt and adjust regardless of how dehumanizing a society has become. So the psychologists, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, we become really tools to just maintain a status quo. And so therefore I thought, boy, there needs to be something equivalent to liberation theology, a kind of liberation psychology. And I thought I had invented this term, Scott, but actually other people had also thought the same thing. And the person who really deserves the most credit for popularizing this term is a guy named Ignacio Martin Barrow. And he was an El Salvadoran social psychologist who was also a Jesuit priest, by the way. And sadly, 1989, he was assassinated by a U.S.-trained El Salvadoran death squad. And Martin Barrow, he got a lot of his ideas about liberation psychology from a lot of what was going on in Central America, South America, Africa. People like Paulo Freire, who wrote The Psychology of the Oppressed. Lots of people around the world, not so much social scientists in America, are hip to the idea that when people become externally oppressed for too long, they develop a kind of internal oppression, a kind of fatalism, a kind of defeatism, or what Bob Marley, who's sort of the poet laureate of oppressed people around the world, what he called mental slavery. And so, of course, he sang about emancipating ourselves from mental slavery. And that's a huge thing, I think, that what I'm trying to introduce and get up stand-up is that we need to start understanding this stuff for America, because I know this is humiliating for a lot of Americans to accept this, but we, too, now have been kind of moved into this kind of a fatalism, this defeatism, this kind of mental slavery. And it's hard for Americans because our tyrants have not been these kind of Mubarak, these kind of Pinochet kind of characters. It's been something much more impersonal, this kind of corporatocracy that I talk about.
Bruce, in your book, you lay out how you believe a democracy like ours here in the United States uses various methods in order to transform a population into a passive and often the case cynical citizens, unwilling to participate, not wanting to participate in a system, thereby leaving it to the powerful actors, the lobbyists, the corporations to really have their way with our government. Tell us about the various methods that you believe are used in the process of making a people passive, cynical, and decide not to participate.
Well, there are classic techniques in psychology, and I mean, you don't need a PhD for this. It's kind of common sense stuff. I should say my profession has a way sort of burying basic common sense one generation, and then we uncover it with fancy experiments the next generation. And in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there were a series of learned helplessness experiments that basically what they showed, which is common sense for most people, that when you put an animal in a situation where there's nothing they can do to control, to stop the pain, that you put them in another task, even when they do have a chance to reduce the pain, say move out of a box where they're being electroshocked, they don't even try to escape. And so there's many kind of parts of our culture and society where you see that kind of learned helplessness. So for example, our national elections, our certainly our presidential elections, yes, there are differences between these Democrats and Republicans, but basically on the big issues of senseless wars and corporate control, you vote for a Democrat, you're going to get senseless wars and corporate control. You're going to, certainly Republicans, my God, we get two wars and Obama's maintained them. You go ahead and you try to vote for a third party like a Green Party. Well, the way our national elections are set up, a third party has no chance of winning. Money controls these elections. And then, or if you stay home and you don't vote at all, well, you still get Republican or Democrat and you get corporate control and senseless wars. So lots of other institutions in American life play out this learned helplessness, but there are other psychological principles too that I go through, get up, stand up, like the abuse syndrome, and I talk about how we are sort of subject to this kind of corporatocracy abuse or sort of battered people syndrome.
We only have a minute or so left, but why don't you talk briefly about some of the groups that are organizing out there now that you think provide a good blueprint for what other progressive and populist folks who want to get organized and challenge injustices, what they can take away from these groups?
There are basically two kind of strategies of democratic movements. One is to kind of just withdraw and create your own alternative economy, your own kind of self-reliance. So the workers' co-ops and your producer co-ops. The other kind of thing is, because sometimes you can't pull that off, sometimes it's just impossible. And so the other way that you create a democratic movement is you withdraw cooperation. You create disruptions for authorities, and you force them to negotiate. And so those are your underground railroad, your busing boycotts, and your great labor strikes. Those are that's what's done there. And a good example, one example that's going on today with not very many people, small groups of people in a Boston organization called City Life, dealing with people who are losing their homes, foreclosure, recognize that banks hate bad publicity. They just hate it. And so they've organized blockades and vigils in front of banks, gotten all kinds of media publicity for that, and embarrassed these banks, shamed them because they didn't want to deal with the stock price repercussions, into negotiating with them, giving them fairer loan rates, sometimes even reducing the principal. And so there's been some effective ways of dealing with the corporate elite out there. If you understand what they care about, which is money, and you understand what kind of power you really have, and you actually use wise tactics and wise strategies.
That was Bruce Levine, a clinical psychologist and author whose new book is titled Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. For more information on Levine's inspirational writing, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Topp. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.